Welcome back to American Scene. I'm Ben Rosen, back again to talk about three more movies with American in the title and what they have to say about American culture, identity, and values. If you like the show, please be sure to subscribe, give us a rating, and follow us on Instagram at American Scene Pod, where I promise I'll actually be posting when we have a new episode and not just adding to our story. I think I forgot to post the last episode. I'm still working my way through a bunch of movies that have come out since 2020. On the last episode, I talked about the privilege and ineptitude of an American Sicario, the metaphor for seeking safety and a secure future in the US, an American refugee, and the power of forging connections in American insurrection. Of all the movies I've covered recently, I really recommend checking that one out. And I know I said I would only be doing 9 movies that have come out since 2020, but in doing these episodes, I have discovered 3 more movies that have come out since 2020, so it looks like I have a bit more work ahead of me before I start to dig back into the pre-COVID catalog. The movies I'm talking about today each center on crime, so without further ado, let's begin.
We're building an apartment complex, putting in every dime.
We're putting in our own sweat.
But we're coming up short.
Everything I got is in that renovation. And that's our future.
Where's the money coming from?
Europe.
He's a very dangerous man. He's a criminal.
He's our only choice.
You need money? You only say 700,000.
Thank you.
No, this is not the Oscar-winning Barbara Kopple documentary from 1990, nor is it the Janet Leigh film from 1966. This is American Dream, the 2021 film directed by 2-time Oscar-winning cinematographer Janusz Kaminski, written by Duncan Brantley and Mark Wheaton. The film stars Mikhail Husman as Nikki, Luke Bracey as Scott, Nick Stahl as Yuri, Agnieszka Grakowska as Anna, and Samantha Ressler as Brooke. In the film, entrepreneurs Scotty and Nikki are desperate for cash to finish their construction project for a housing complex, and when it seems like all potential banks have turned them down, they turn to Yuri, an apparently successful business person they meet at a wedding. He arranges for them to receive funding from a sketchy old Russian dude in a bathhouse, and they immediately accept the offer, unaware of whatever strings might be attached, only to decline it the next day when Scott's father comes through for them. Infuriated, Yuri pressures them to pay him off, ultimately demanding to take over their project and, along the way, threatening them and their girlfriends in various ways. Nikki and Scott try to get help from another old Russian mobster, but it's ultimately up to them and Nikki's girlfriend Anna to end things once and for all. But this doesn't go as planned either, and the movie ends with Yuri's former henchmen rolling up to their completed project with a different mobster at the helm, ready to sink their claws into Scott and Nikki once again. I had watched this trailer several times the past few years before I finally sat down to watch it, and I know reviews were very unkind, so I don't know why I was still holding out hope that it would be at least entertaining, but I just really expected more. Aside from his 2 Oscars for Saving Private Ryan and Schindler's List, Kaminski was also nominated for cinematography for Amistad, Diving Bell and the Butterfly, War Horse, Lincoln, and West Side Story. He's one of a handful of very well-known cinematographers who made their names not only with incredible work, but also from their collaborations with acclaimed filmmakers. Others include, you know, Roger Deakins and the Coen brothers, Wally Pfister and Hoyte van Hoytema with Christopher Nolan, Robert Richardson with Tarantino, Scorsese, and Oliver Stone. I know there are others, but those are the ones I could come up with without even really thinking. Successfully transitioning to directing, of course, isn't a sure thing despite their talents as directors of photography. Wally Pfister directed the Johnny Depp AI thriller Transcendence, and that was also not good. I love Rebecca Hall, but just, you know, no. And Kaminski himself previously directed the critically reviled 2000 film Lost Souls starring Winona Ryder. More than 2 decades later, it's sad to say the reviews got this one right. For a thriller, it's pretty boring. For a mob movie, it's not especially violent. For a movie that opens with a sequence that centers Anna, her role is shoved off to the side for most of the runtime. And for what should be a straightforward drama, it can actually be difficult to follow the twists and turns and, you know, why characters are making certain decisions. But despite its many flaws, it still offers us something to talk about. Accepting the story on its face, and I'll be happy to nitpick later, when it seems like they have no legitimate options for success, Nikki and Scott make a poor decision that haunts them, that they can't put behind them despite their best efforts to stay legit in its aftermath. It's a decision that will, as the ending implies, continue to haunt them even after they think they've buried this person who's been hounding them. This is some effective commentary on the obstacles to making it in America. One mistake can taint any opportunity for future success. If you dip your toe in the muck, it can suck you down, and despite your best efforts, you'll never be truly clean. If you're arrested and you spend time in prison, in many places in America, and according to civilrights.org, you'll not be able to vote, you'll have little access to education, you'll face scant job opportunities, and you'll be ineligible for public benefits and public housing. Plus, as far as I know, if you spent time in prison, you also can't stay with family if they're in public housing or they risk losing the benefit, not to mention the often nearly impossible to follow rules set by parole boards and parole officers. And according to the Washington Post, in a story from just a few weeks ago, from August 2023, nearly 14,000 laws and regulations restrict individuals with arrest and conviction histories from becoming licensed in certain fields, and the rules that govern these barriers to entry are patchwork, scattered across federal, state, and regulatory codes, and they can vary from field to field, even within a state. These barriers keep people from good jobs, not only reducing their chances of staying out of prison, but also robbing the nation of their productive labor. With all those obstacles, a report from the Bureau of Justice Statistics in December 2021 estimated that about 60% of formerly incarcerated people are jobless. Now, the story in American Dream doesn't involve going to prison or involving the police in any way. Nikki and Scott absolutely should have reported that they were getting shaken down by Yuri, but that's, you know, just one of many nitpicks. But it expresses the same kind of idea. When Yuri presents them the opportunity for the investment from the guy in the bathhouse, and when the guys initially accept, the rules for repayment are not explained. When Yuri freaks out at them on the construction site the next day for stopping the check, it's kind of hard to understand why he's so angry. It's like he says the balance in his account is supposed to be zero, and the guys are like, but only we stopped it before all the money got moved, only $11,000 got moved. But now in Nikki and Scott owe Yuri $7,000 for consulting so things can stay above board, and Yuri gives them an invoice in a very strange scene where he just happens to know they're at the beach and he just like hands them the thing. Like, how did you know where I am? Like, well, you don't get a tan like that, you know, in an office. Like, what? How did, but of all the beaches, there's a lot of beaches in LA. Anyway, and then because Nikki and Scott pay him only $2,500 initially, now there's interest on the $7,000, and eventually Yuri wants a piece of the business to leave them alone. It feels like Yuri is making it all up as he goes along, which can definitely be how it feels trying to navigate laws and regulations and red tape in American business. You have to do this or that and go to this office and meet this deadline and this other threshold, and there are plenty of people along the way who will take your money to help you navigate these mazes. There are entire industries propped up by intentional complexities. I mean, just think of filing your taxes. In other countries, the government figures it out for you, but in America, the tax prep lobby has made it so that the onus is on the everyday person to file their taxes themselves and pray they filed everything correctly, or pay TurboTax or H&R Block a couple hundred bucks to take the burden off of them. And the threat of an audit or of accidentally committing tax fraud is enough to scare people into forking over that money to tax preppers to do it for them. And it is everyday people who face that threat of getting audited or accidentally committing fraud. Because the IRS has been defunded, it's easier for them to audit lower income folks than it is to audit wealthy people who typically have more complicated tax returns. All that to say, if you're already lower income, if a bank won't approve your loan, if you don't have the help to navigate the complexities of the business world, it's going to be very hard to succeed. And if you make one mistake, intentionally or not, you risk a shadow looming over you far into the future. There's a similar theme in Catch Me If You Can, the DiCaprio-Tom Hanks movie that I love, that Kaminsky worked on with Spielberg. That one seemingly small mistake takes Christopher Walken from a well-regarded local shop owner to a bus driver. And there's another theme in Catch Me If You Can that American Dream borrows, that how you appear influences how people regard you. Yuri shows up to the wedding in a suit and he's in a fancy car, but it turns out he was just renting the car for the night, and he's usually driving around in an old Mercedes. Most of the time, Yuri's wearing that same fancy suit, but when he's in one of his laundromats emptying the machines for quarters, he's just wearing sweatpants. And even though Yuri behaves as if he has all the power over Nikki and Scott, when he's among other Russian mobsters with real power, he's a nobody who still has to prove himself. Not that we should feel bad for Yuri, although at a couple points it feels like the movie wants us to, like when an old Russian mobster scolds him or when we see him having to pay for sex. And it's hard to feel bad for Nikki and Scott too, like Scott's dad already has a successful business, and when the movie starts, Nikki and Scott are like so far into the building project that it's hard to understand why they don't already have a loan secured to finish it. Like, much of the structure is already in place. So it's just weird that they're like, oh, we don't have the money. It's going to run out tomorrow and we don't have the loan secured. Just like very bad at managing time and money, apparently. Plus, the most noticeable thing about Nikki and Scott is that they're attractive young white men, the type of guys that the business world embraces much more commonly than anyone else. The commentary that one mistake could ruin your future would be a lot more effective with different characters at the center. But anyway, before I tie up this part of the episode and drive it off into the desert, let's also throw in the trunk a bunch of American moments.
You're playing our song.
First, I personally love the contrast in the transition from the train system in Russia to the web of a freeway interchange in Los Angeles. Freeways like this are incredibly American. Next is when Yuri explains that if you work your ass off, you can make it here. You make money, money gets you power, power gets you respect, respect you gets you more money. It's a very American attitude to have, although I don't think it's necessarily true that if you work your ass off you can make it, but it is certainly true that here money gets you power and respect, even if you don't deserve either. Happen to be looking at you, Elon Musk, and any millionaire who ever won an election. But my favorite moment is when Nikki's dad sits down on the couch to watch TV, and he says, baseball, always baseball, which is, you know, another attempt at a Russian accent, like from American Pickle. But I like this moment because he contrasts baseball with soccer. The rules of soccer are relatively simple. You put the ball in the goal. The rules and strategies for baseball, on the other hand, are much more complicated. Soccer originated abroad, whereas baseball is an American invention. So to me, the metaphor works. And then, I don't know, one of the last shots shows the completed building that Nikki and Scott own, and it's just, I don't know, looks pretty boring and ugly, like a lot of this movie. A boring, unattractive housing complex that seems totally disconnected to the city around it feels pretty American to me. Oh, one more moment I just thought of is when Scott has to sell his car and we see him skateboard away. He looks so dejected. Like, I know that this moment is more like, oh, we're doing the last things we could possibly do, and he has to sell his car, you know, just to try to make, like, ends meet, just to, like, pay off Yuri or whatever. But it's like he's fallen so far to not have a car in America, to have to skateboard in Los Angeles. What a bummer. Like, what a total loser. Car ownership is definitely and sadly a part of the American dream. And as someone who skated around Los Angeles because I hated driving in the city, I take this particular moment as a personal attack. Anyway, it's tough to do punny transitions without Alan, like I used to, but I can't help but to ask, when do we American dream? Usually at American night.
Powerful people from every century have even gone to the length of killing to obtain a masterpiece.
Woo! Oh my God!
The gallery is too much of a risk. They want their money back in 48 hours, John.
The pink Marilyn, that's my inheritance.
Faster!
My father promised it to me and I want it back because it's mine.
How did you get this?
If you ask me, it looks like a 5-year-old could have done it. But I want a bigger cut because I found it, all right?
American Night is the 2021 film written and directed by Alessio Della Valle, starring Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, Emile Hirsch, Paz Vega, Jeremy Piven, Alba Ramadani, Annabelle Belmondo, Mara Lane, and Michael Madsen. Art and life collide in this neo-noir thriller. I just grabbed that from Rotten Tomatoes. When the highly coveted Andy Warhol painting Pink Marilyn suddenly surfaces, it triggers a chain reaction of car chases, foot chases, explosions, and shootouts for a colorful group of characters, including a forger turned art dealer, John, played by Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, a mobster and wannabe painter taking over his recently deceased father's business, Michael, played by Emile Hirsch, a museum conservator, Sarah, played by Paz Vega, and a stuntman in a career crisis, Vincent, played by Jeremy Piven. Not to mention the art dealer's assistant, two other women going after the painting, and the unlucky and occasionally narcoleptic courier transporting the art. Lots of twists and turns, told in three parts from all their various perspectives and in a non-linear narrative. And by the end, Emile Hirsch is doing his best impression of Vincent D'Onofrio in Daredevil, another bald, dangerous art collector. This, like American Dream, is also pretty bad, and also kind of incoherent, but there are a couple things worth talking about. First, in a flashback to Michael as a young boy, his father tells him, Marilyn, referring to the painting, is the symbol of our empire. Even though Marilyn is not really a part of the narrative until part three, it's set up in part one as being central to Michael's relationship with his father and to his collection of art. Marilyn Monroe, of course, was a symbol of American beauty and fame. Women wanted to be her, men wanted to be with her, but there was darkness underneath, drama and torment and abuse that ultimately ended in a tragic early death. And in the same way that men used Marilyn for their own selfish interests, so too are Michael and John using this painting for their own selfish interests. Michael wants to own her, she belongs to him, and John wants to keep the original for himself and pass along a forgery. They're both corrupting her, and they're both comfortable and confident in those decisions. Similar to the Marilyn painting, Michael and John are also fighting over Sarah, in another sense, the ownership of a woman. Even if John originally had a genuine connection with her, he has since corrupted it through his nefarious behavior. Michael Madsen's character comes in because he's some kind of representative for criminal investors in John's gallery who may or may not be related to Michael. Like I said, not easy to follow. The film makes John out to be a hero, rescuing Sarah as a sleeping beauty from a burning building, but then the end of the story winds back to show that he was a key part of putting these disastrous plans in motion to intercept the Pink Marilyn, so he is not innocent, and both he and Michael die for their wrongdoing. On the other hand, Sarah and Jeremy Piven's character, Vincent, are the only ones who survive the climactic bloodbath. She's a museum conservator whose role is to preserve art, and he is a stuntman who has embodied, over the course of the story, the teachings of Bruce Lee to be like water. They're both approaching art with purity in a way that they can appreciate it and be a part of it without the need to own it. And in that way, the art can stand the test of time. So is the film saying anything about America more broadly? I think the Michaels of the world who want to hoard art, control the world of art, and may even fancy themselves artists despite a lack of originality or true inspiration or ambition are rampant in the American arts. You have studio heads and record labels and art collectors and folks like Ticketmaster and Live Nation who control what pieces of art and what kind of art is promoted and accessible and to whom and at what price. Their interest in the arts is only to make it maximally profitable for shareholders, not to create lasting art. If you've been paying attention to the ongoing WGA and SAG strikes, then you know studios are fighting to pay as little as they can get away with to create the most amount of content for their platforms. It's not about art or fostering the careers of artists, it's about money. And because of this system, even those who may get into the arts with the best of intentions and ideals around what art should be, like John, even they can be corrupted. Look at, showrunners who preserve the kind of toxic workplaces they had to endure, or just every artist who pulls up the ladder behind them. Those few artists who retain real power are the exceptions that prove the rule. Another interesting element, the film opens on Michael using a gun as part of his work of art. He throws some paint on a canvas and then riddles it with bullet holes. And in another early scene, Michael, as a young boy, is told to put down his crayons and instead to pick up a knife. In both instances, we're watching him put down a tool of creation and pick up a tool of destruction. He still wants to make art, but he's been taught to use knives and guns. Violence is their family's business, not art. And violence is more lucrative. In the same way, in America, pursuing the arts is not well supported at a fundamental level. You can see in other countries how their TV and film productions, as just one example, are supported by general funds and lottery funds that just pay attention to the opening company credits for a foreign film, and you'll see it. In the UK, a TV tax funds the BBC. Meanwhile, in the US, arts funding is one of the first things to go when cities and states are trying to balance their budgets. It's not a priority, it's seen as a frill. So what does America prioritize? What does America spend most of its money on? Defense, the military, weapon systems, the police, in a word, violence. America has made it such that violence is much more lucrative. And now, speaking of knives, let's cut to some American moments.
You're playing our song.
Off the bat, the car chase and the shootout, very American. Not sure we've had any or many of these in other films that we've covered. I want to say maybe there was a horseback chase in American Outlaws. That was probably the only one. There's a line said to the courier when he orders huevos rancheros at a bar. They don't have Mexicans where you come from. They're coming and taking all your worst jobs. This feels like the line kind of comes out of nowhere. I don't really know, contextually why this line is in there. And a black guy says it, no less, to the courier. Alan won't like that I'm mentioning this, but mass murder in a public establishment. An American moment. Yikes. And in fact, after witnessing the gun battle, one of the women says to the other, welcome to America. They're watching from, like, a car across the street. American Night is the name of a nightclub that appears in the film. There's music and dancing and a bar and an art exhibition happening here. Nothing really happens at the nightclub. A bunch of characters meet, but like most of the action takes place in other locations. But in any case, I can't think of a worse place for an art exhibition than in a dance club with sweaty drunk people, but maybe that's just me. There's a TED talk that sounds profound but is ultimately meaningless, especially in the context of the rest of the movie. There's a random generic protest in the street at some point that is entirely incidental. There's no mention of any kind of social unrest in the rest of the narrative we're watching, so I'm not sure how this is supposed to help clarify the themes. There's a sign we see that says "We can't breathe." Of course, you know, signs said that in the 2020 protests, but the movie has nothing to do with racial violence or state violence, and you can hear people chanting something about "down with banks," but banks don't play a role in the narrative either. We also get to meet another art forger in this movie, which reminds me of American Hustle. And speaking of forgeries, in the way that a forgery is supposed to unnoticeably copy a work of art, American Night is attempting to unnoticeably copy a film like Pulp Fiction, with its intersecting narratives and time jumping and violence, but it is a poor imitation. It's just an incomprehensible mess of a film with actors who honestly could do a lot better. And I've moved past American moments at this point, but one funny thing I did note about the actors in this movie is that all three male leads were really at the peak of their fame and power in 2007. Emile Hirsch is coming off The Girl Next Door and Alpha Dog, and he stars in Into the Wild in 2007, a movie I just rewatched a few months ago, and still absolutely just so, so good. Jonathan Rhys-Meyers is coming off of Match Point, Mission Impossible 3, and apparently playing Elvis in a 2005 miniseries I never knew about, and he has the Tudors premiere in 2007. Jeremy Piven is in Smoke and Aces in 2006, The Kingdom in 2007, and Entourage. Is probably, like, in its heyday at this point. Somehow it has the back half of season 3 and all of season 4 in 2007. But now that we're coming to the end of American Night, it's time to shed light on the last film for today's episode.
I think everybody has one thing they're good at. One superpower.
Is this the man they call the Badger?
This is Marcella Orsova. We need you to make contact and find out everything you can about her.
Hi. You're back.
What kind of work do you do?
American Badger is a 2021 film written and directed by Kirk Cowette, starring Cowette, Andrea Stefancikova, and Michael Kopsa. Cowette stars as The Badger. His real name is Dean. It's a movie that feels like Drive meets John Wick, which is actually pretty cool. Dean's wife died several years ago from cancer, and Dean spends his days with his dog, not doing much except smoking and hanging around his rundown apartment, waiting for his handlers to contact him online for a new job. He's a hitman, and he seems to be pretty good at it, until he gets a new assignment to make friends with a cam girl slash sex worker named Velvet, aka Marcella, to learn what she knows about the inner workings of an Albanian mob family she works for. Really, she's, you know, being trafficked by them. Dean is a recluse who hasn't spoken to a woman in years, but he finds Marcella and earns her trust by saving her from an aggressive John. He doesn't talk much, but they forge a connection, somehow, that turns into an unlikely romance. Dean learns from his handlers that the mob family is leaving town, so they order him to kill Marcella, the Albanians, and mob boss Vasily, who's been an abusive father figure to Marcella for as long as she's been trafficked. Instead, Dean teaches Marcella to use guns, and they take on the bad guys together, with Dean telling her they can be together and they won't have to run away from anything. But when she comes face to face with Vasily in one of their gun battles, Marcella realizes the truth behind Dean's assignment, and she lets Vasily escape, and she leaves Dean. Dean kills the rest of the Albanian gang, steals their cash, and returns to Marcella's apartment just as she's being accosted by Vasily and one of his goons. Together, they kill the two men, but instead of going off together, Marcella takes off in Vasily's car with the cash and Dean's dog, and Dean returns to his rundown apartment, curled in the fetal position on the floor. Off the bat, I'll say this movie looks like it was shot in 2006 and plays on some well-worn crime movie tropes. As in American Dream, there's sexual violence against women. As in American Night, the lead female character needs to be rescued. But it's probably the best of these three in terms of style, pacing, and just simple narrative coherence. And in the way it ends, I think it also subverts a certain trope that adds a surprising depth to the film. I like that there's limited dialogue, and even as I'm thinking about it and talking about it, it makes sense that the conversations between Dean and Marcella as they're forging a connection feel so unnatural, because neither of them, due to their isolation, would really know a natural way to forge a connection. The best parts are the fight scenes, which are all excellently staged in a visceral Jason Bourne kind of way, and the film clocks in at 85 minutes, which is just always welcome. More short movies, please. I'm begging you. I feel like this film is in conversation with American Assassin. That movie features a similarly incel-esque violent guy, but what that movie got wrong, as Alan and I talked about, is that it made the character a hero, praised by the CIA for the particular set of skills and attitude he possesses, whereas in this movie, Dean is not a hero. The movie opens with text that describes the Badger as easily agitated and aggressive when threatened, and specifically the American Badger as highly antisocial and preferring to be left alone. Dean also says at the beginning of the movie that he likes to let others make decisions for him, because then he can never make a mistake, and if he never makes a mistake, he's always a winner, and we all just want to be winners. Which I think speaks to the issue of American masculinity that we're recognizing more and more lately. Many boys and men are easily agitated, aggressive when threatened, antisocial. They're lonely, disconnected, self-medicating, violent, and as far as letting others make decisions for them, they're taking guidance from popular figures and podcast hosts and social media characters who preach a kind of stoicism and independence that denies real human emotional needs. Leslie Jones literally just did a segment about this the other day on The Daily Show, and I'll put the link in the episode description. So boys and men learn from these people that the same behaviors that have resulted in their loneliness and isolation and a lack of empathy are actually masculine virtues. It's right and good and natural for men to be stoic and independent and antisocial, and it's society that's wrong if it's telling you to act differently. That this performance of masculinity will help you, quote-unquote, win, i.e., you know, find financial success, a partner, build a traditional family, and if this performance doesn't work, then they're not doing it well enough. And if the framing is winners versus losers, then it's putting men in opposition to others as opposed to putting them in harmony with the social fabric. Similar to listening to the guidance of online figures like, you know, Andrew Tate, in American Badger, Dean has given up his own agency to his handlers, aptly called handlers on the digital program he uses to interact with them. It's not a specific person, there's no fictional company name, just handlers. If he follows their orders, he can never be wrong. He'll always win. And just like it's in the interests of certain channels to keep their audience lonely and angry, because it keeps them coming back to their shows, it's in the handler's interest that Dean think this way so that he remains in the same place, always available to do their bidding. Even when he feels upset by their orders, it's momentary. He rolls over and does what he's told. When he meets someone he'd like to forge a real connection with, though, he doesn't have the tools to truly connect with her. The only way of being he knows is stoicism and violence, which he uses in an attempt to deepen their bond. He teaches her how to use guns, and he brings her into his assignment. And the story uses the action movie cliché, Dean sees the love and support from Marcella as a substitute for his own internal growth. He wants to save her, for her to see him as a savior so that he can be validated for who he is, so she can save him from a life of meaninglessness and impotence. But there is no happy ending for Dean. The tools that have resulted in his isolation can't also be the means by which he finds his way back to humanity. When Marcella leaves him before the climactic set piece, he says nothing. He does nothing. He doesn't even look at her, because he doesn't know how to communicate his feelings. So he doesn't ride off into the sunset with the girl and the money and the dog, smiling and ready to start a new life. He ends up curled in a ball, on the floor, accepting that he'll continue to let others make decisions for him, saying again, and it sounds ironic this time, that this way he'll never make a mistake, and he'll always win. I like this ending because it's a more accurate reflection of real life. A man who's lived the past several years the way Dean has is not suddenly going to be able to successfully navigate his feelings or a relationship. Not without a crapload of therapy. He's gonna end up alone. American media, and especially the kinds of action films Badger for much of its runtime is imitating, has also influenced the way men treat each other, what men feel is expected of them in society, in relationships, in a family, and how they behave towards women. As much as I love the Bourne movies, and Supremacy is the best, perfect ending, incredible score by John Powell, they feature a similarly stoic, save-the-girl kind of character. So it's refreshing to see a story that takes the form of a traditional action movie but subverts expectations for its resolution. Boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy does not get girl back. Now, let's take a break from the action to light up Badger's American moments.
You're playing our song.
In voiceover, Dean mentions some of the things he thinks about with all the free time he has. He mentions who killed the Kennedys, is this all a dream, do aliens exist, and even saying you'd have to be pretty stupid to think that a bunch of monkeys with guns are the highest forms of intelligence in the universe, which for sure is an American POV, because no other country makes guns so central to their identity. There's also a moment when they save a girl from being trafficked by the Albanians, and Marcella wonders if she'll be okay, and Dean says without hesitation and without much thought that the police will take her to a hospital and they'll make sure she finds a new family. And it's strange that someone who has witnessed the world from the perspective that he has, that he would be so confident in the kinds of institutions that have, by lack of effort or oversight, allowed human trafficking to persist. I had a hunch, so I searched for news about human trafficking in the foster care system and found that the National Foster Youth Institute estimated that 60% of child sex trafficking victims have been within foster care or another part of the larger child welfare system. That may not be unique to America, but it's the blind trust in systems that, by the way they're set up and run, in some ways perpetuate the problems we face that, to me, reflects American attitudes. I see it every time I speak up for homeless people or even, like, bike lanes on Twitter. It's a bummer to end the episode on that note, but one thing I'll add, now that I've gotten through these 9 movies, is that for a while, we could trust that an American flag was going to show up somewhere in the movies we cover, and for some reason, I can't remember seeing the flag in any of these movies. So, I don't know. It's curious to me. Maybe it's nothing, or, you know, as John Voight says in Enemy of the State, maybe it's everything. What I do know is that for now, that's a wrap on American Dream, American Knight, and American Badger. Thank you so much for listening. If you like what we're doing, please give us a rating, leave a positive review, and you can give us your unfiltered opinion on Instagram at AmericanScenePod. And we'll see you next time.